Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Old Men and the Three ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
You know, these long West Coast trips to call games have given me the gift of time. Time to put on some headphones and listen to my favorite audio titles on Audible. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. From bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries, and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. Now, I personally love a good murder mystery, and I'm currently listening to An Honest Man by Michael Corrida. It's about murders on a yacht. What more do I need to say? As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/JJ or text JJ to 500-500. That's audible.com/JJ or text JJ to 500-500. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good, but that's when you say to yourself, it's time to get back in the game and take as much of my friend's money as I possibly can. That's right. The hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to be the biggest tycoon ever. It's classic Monopoly, but anytime with tons of twists. Play on countless Monopoly boards, charge your friends rent, or smash their landmarks with a wrecking ball. You can even team up with friends for extra rewards. So put on your game face and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. Welcome to The Old Men and the Three with J.J. Redick and Tommy Alter, brought to you by 342 Productions. This is episode 148. Paul George. Tommy, I was really impressed with Paul. So insightful. We talked about some high-level NBA stuff. We talked about the Clippers. We talked about coming back from injury. We talked about him teaming up with Russ in OKC. How I think the Indiana Pacers sort of changed the modern NBA. There was a lot of great basketball talk in here. Paul has made 8 All-Star games, 6 All-NBA, 4 All-Defensive teams, most improved player, All-Rookie team. He's had a great career. And the Clippers looking to win the first championship in franchise history. Lost last night to the Minnesota Timberwolves. They are now in 6th place. And again, we not to, you know, hammer home the point too much, but Phoenix right now with 29 losses, OKC in 13th place with 33 losses, as does LA. But you look at 6 through 11, Clippers have 31 losses, Dallas has 31, and then Minnesota, Utah, New Orleans, and Portland all have 32. So much intrigue over the last 20 games of the season. And so let's kind of assess where we think the Clippers are right now. Because a lot of people, and I'm one of them, think that they still, despite, a mediocre record, and by the way, a mediocre record, even over the last 23 games, Kawhi has played in 20 of those, just 12-8 when he plays now. 3 losses in a row since they got Russ. They're, in some ways, a hard team to figure out.
As of this morning, they're, according to NBA.com, they're 20th in offense and 12th in defense. Disappointment may be a little strong. I mean, this is a team that's going to be in the playoffs, but are you a little surprised at where they sort of stand metrically, you know, as we are now in March?
I am, and it's weird, Tommy, because if you look at their season, because this is a team that I've been tracking the whole season, it's a team that it's a team that I stay up for, especially if Kawhi's gonna play. It's a team that I like to watch. They started out the season really good offensively. Oh, I'm sorry, really good defensively. They were a top 5 defense for the first part of the season. Really bad offensively, and that paradigm has shifted and just completely reversed. So I use January 8th because that's when Kawhi really started to play well. It's also when his minutes went up. So since January 8th, they are 12-11. In those 20 games of those 23 games that Kawhi has played, they're 12-8. They have the 4th best offense over that stretch and the 22nd best defense. And one of the things, if you watch them, and by the way, Ben Taylor of Thinking Basketball has a great 15-minute video on the Thinking Basketball YouTube channel. I would highly recommend to watch it. It breaks down the Kings-Clippers game that went into double overtime, second highest scoring game of all time. but it breaks it down and it shows how difficult it is really to get stops given the amount of space and given the amount of ball handling and shooting that's on the floor. But one thing that you take away from that, and if you have watched the Clippers, you can see this, the point of attack. Ty Lue said this to me Sunday night when I interviewed him pregame with Ryan Rucco. Their point of attack defense, their ability to contain the basketball is poor. And against the Kings, as of right now, their matchup in the first round, they have problems containing De'Aaron Fox. And I don't think Russ is the answer for that. So is it Paul George? Is it Kawhi? You're asking a lot of those guys to try to contain De'Aaron Fox. The other point I wanted to make on that video, but this is a breakdown that I've seen over the last 2 months defensively. They have played small a lot of times, especially if Zubats is out of the lineup like he's been. They have communication issues. And again, I don't think Russ solves those communication issues. So when they're switching, especially off the ball, they give up a lot of open looks. And we saw that in the Kings game. Malik Monk, Kevin Huerter, Keegan Murray. There's a lot of point switching, right? So that, to me, is the two issues defensively. And look, I think Ty Lue is a great coach. I think their guys want to win, and I think they're like trying to be engaged. But at some point, you have to have concerns about them defensively, which is crazy given that we all thought going into the season with the amount of depth and size and length they had, that would be a strength of their team.
One other question I was going to come off of the Kings game, but it's really been an issue for them in their last three games, is the turnovers.
Yes.
In the Kings game, they gave up 42 points off turnovers alone, which is the most in the NBA in the last four seasons. They have 62 turnovers in their last three. They actually have been pretty good since January 19th. They were really bad to start the season. They've improved in the last three games. They've kind of regressed to where they were before. Is there something about them specifically that you think is causing this problem? I mean, obviously nobody wants to turn the ball over, but it clearly is hurting the defense as well.
I think in the Paul George Kawhi era, the one thing that has been missing is a true table setter for those guys. Again, you're not going to get Chris Paul for $30 million a year in free agency. So that's out of the question. You're not going to get Tyus Jones. Like, the low turnover point guards, those guys are very valuable. And Terrence Mann has played point at times. They now have Russ. Russ is a high turnover guy. He's always been a high turnover guy. We shouldn't be surprised by that. You know, I think a lot of Clippers fans right now are talking about Paul's turnovers. And he had a couple in that Kings game that were particularly befuddling. But I was looking PG over his last 17. So same date, right? That January 8th date. He's played in 17 of the 23 games. 23 a game, 6 rebounds, 5 assists, 48-38 shooting splits, 1.4 steals. 3 turnovers a game. I'm not saying that's inconsequential, but for a higher usage player, that's fairly normal. Overall, they're 18th in turnover percentage, but yeah, some of that is just not having that sort of natural point guard to get you into sets and to sort of control the game in the half court. Here's an interesting thing about the Clippers. On DraftKings Sportsbook, they have the most amount of bets to win the Western Conference, the most amount of bets, but only 3% of the money. So there's a lot of people that are taking a little bit of a, you know, $20, $5, whatever it may be.
A flyer.
Yeah, but I mean, the crazy thing is they have the third best odds. So the odds are not like in your favor to play small bets. The Nuggets have the most handle, the most money bet on them to win the Western Conference. And then it's Clippers at 21% of the bets. You've got the Warriors 19, Nuggets 18, Phoenix 16. That seems right to me in terms of the top four teams. I do find it fascinating that they have the most amount of money, the Clippers do, the most amount of money on them most amount of bets on them to win the Western Conference, yet they're not in the top 10 for most amount of bets placed on them to win the championship. That seems very weird to me. They're 12th, despite having the fifth best odds to win the NBA championship. Where do I see them right now, Tommy? I think they're outside looking in terms of being a tier one team. We're going to see, hopefully tonight, it's been reported, KD is going to play tonight. Hopefully tonight we see the first version of this Phoenix Suns team. They're in fourth. Golden State, let's give them some props here. After last night's comeback win in Portland, they're now in fifth place. Reports yesterday that Steph Curry is going to be back sooner than later. All of a sudden you're like, man, with what Phoenix did, with how Sacramento's playing, obviously Memphis, of course Denver, those top six teams in the West, I mean, those series are going to be bloodbaths.
Yeah, it's tough. And it seems like the Clippers, I mean, I know they added a bunch up the bench. We talked about that last week, but they just have a lot to figure out compared to some of these other teams who, you know, seem to have their identity already. I wanted to ask about Kawhi.
Yeah.
In particular, we talk about this with Paul. And even, you know, even though they lost against the Kings, I mean, his numbers were insane. What have you seen from him from the game the other night? What have you seen from him in particular over the last, you know, 2 or 3 weeks as he's rounding back into kind of like, you know, cyborg Kawhi form?
What gives me hope for the Clippers, having faced off against Kawhi three times in the playoffs, 15 in the first round when he was with the Spurs, 19 with the Raptors. And then, of course, I was hurt with Dallas, but his game six performance when they're down 3-2 in Dallas, and Texas had different protocols for fans in stadiums. That was a full 21,000 raucous crowd that night. And he went 18 of 25 for 44 points. So what gives me hope for the Clippers is that you have a two-time finals MVP who is peaking. Look, I think all the numbers are great with Kawhi, 28 points a game, 52% from three, or 52% from the field, 49% floor game, great over the last 37 minutes a game. The fact that he played Friday night, played 46 minutes, comes back, has a great game in Denver, plays more minutes last night. Like, to me, how they've managed him, they've put him in a position now to be peaking in the playoffs. The one guy that, you know, is intriguing to me, and I mentioned him, is Terrence Mann. And one of the things that Ty Lue told us before the game, and this was not like for private, so I'm not sharing something that he probably hasn't already said to the Clippers media, is that once they got Russ and they got Bones Highland, they got Eric Gordon, they got Mason Plumlee, his thinking for this stretch coming out of All-Star break is to tinker a little bit with rotations and try to figure out what he's got. My hope is that Terrence Mann doesn't get lost in the shuffle, and we don't see 15-minute games from Terrence Mann down the stretch and in the playoffs, because I think he's very valuable defensively, and I also think with the way he shot the ball lately, he's another floor spacer. That's not Russ's game. I think Russ has been great so far for them in the three games. The 9 assists particularly stand out. Again, high turnover guy. He's got 4.3 turnovers in the three games. But they've got some things to figure out. What I think they don't have to figure out is Kawhi. That to me is very clear.
I remember after that game, we didn't have time to talk about this with Paul. After that game, the game six in Dallas, you were like, that's Michael Jordan.
I said that the Toronto year too, early in the season. So he goes from San Antonio. He's coming off that injury where he was out a long time. And he goes and, you know, they're load managing him in San Antonio or whatever. And early in that season, I was texting a buddy who works for a team in the NBA, and we were like, is Kawhi, in terms of the mid-range precision, the way he gets to his spots, his post-game, it's the closest thing. I mean, of course, Kobe, but it's the closest thing in current players, I think, to Michael Jordan, that mid-range area. And that's what he's doing right now. So there is hope for the Clippers, but with 18 games to go for them, they definitely have some things to figure out. NBA fans, it's time to bring the hoops action to the palm of your hand with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. This week, new customers can download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and sign up with code JJ. Right now, you can bet $5 on any pregame moneyline bet and get $150 in bonus bets if your team wins. Only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code JJ. Minimum age and eligibility restrictions apply. See show notes for details. Really enjoyed this conversation with Paul George. Let's get to it. All right, let's welcome in LA Clipper Paul George. Paul, thank you for doing this, man. We had your game last night in Denver. I know we chatted beforehand, but very excited about having you on the show. I feel like this is a long time coming. This is not the first time we've put in the request for you. So we really appreciate the time, man.
Nah, anything for you, JJ, man. I'm a fan of your work, and I appreciate you having me on this platform.
We should mention that you are starting your own podcast very soon. I'm mm-hmm. actually really excited to listen to that. I know you'll have a lot to say. What is it about the podcast space and using your own platform and voice that made you interested in starting something like this?
For me, I think it was more just, I'm not a person that shares a lot on social media. I'm not a person that's, I would say, is an open book. And I feel like with me starting my own podcast, I can kind of open myself up the way I want to and write the narrative that I want to write, opposed to people thinking they know who I am or know what I'm about. It's a chance for me to share who I am. And, I'm a person that, you know, I enjoy talking, but I'm not an overly talkative person at the same time. So, you know, it's just a comfortable space that I can just be myself and just let people into who I am.
I mentioned the Denver game last night. There's a few takeaways I had from the game. I want to get to the load management part, because when we got to Denver on Saturday, the Nuggets had told us preemptively that Aaron Gordon was still going to be out and that the starters likely wouldn't play given the travel back from Memphis in the back-to-back. They then subsequently mm-hmm. stunk it up. And you guys were coming off that double overtime thriller, which we'll also get to. But the big takeaway for me was just Jokic and how good he is. Another 40-point triple-double last night. He does things on the basketball court that appear to be simple, but they're really not. And I know you guys have played against him in the playoffs in a 7-game series. What do you see with Jokic? What is it about him that is so special?
Man, he is just, like, it's crazy because he's not by any means the athletic guy on the floor, you know, but he just knows his game. I think he's a player that just knows who he is on that court. And you put a small guy on him, he punishes him. You know, somebody his size, he uses his smarts and wits. It's a tough matchup. And it's one that we failed to figure out so far. But I was blown away because I have quick hands. And like some of the, you know, passes that they were throwing to him, they were kind of out of his range, but the way that he could tip it and get it back to himself, those are usually steals, you know, on anybody else. If that ball is thrown outside of your area, I'm getting it. And the way that he can just quick tip it and get it right back and go right up with it. And, you know, he gets up, you know, pretty quick for a guy that's not athletic. Like his second jump, he's right back on the play. So he's just a tough cover. And like we tried everything from switching to putting myself, Kawhi on him to having Mace guard him. Like it was, you know, we had no answer for him yesterday.
In watching the game, obviously Mason guarded him quite a bit, but at times Nico was on him, you guarded him, Kawhi guarded him. And so a lot of the strategy was around fronting. And that was something I noticed as well on those lob passes over the top. And you guys got a couple of them that were sort of underthrown, but the lob mm-hmm. passes over the top, it, you know, with your guys' length, it seemed like you were going to get the basketball, and he's just able to sort of corral everything within his space. That Dwight was way more athletic than him, but the player that I relate that to, because I played with Dwight, was just mm-hmm. his ability to grab a basketball that was outside of everyone else's space. Like the normal amount of space that a player can cover and get a basketball, Dwight was as good as anyone as getting something outside his space And Jokic does that. The other thing I loved at the end of the game, so obviously Murray has the basketball and you guys put Kawhi on him. You were guarding Jamal and they were running up another pick and roll. So a lot of times it was Eric Gordon's guy late game to get the first switch. And then they'd run the second pick and roll with Jokic to get Eric Gordon on him. And it's that like game of chess at the end of the game that I find so interesting. The manipulation of matchups, and everybody does it, but that's the part of the game to me right now that is like really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, like you said, it's chess. And so like we were doing it on our end, you know, we found like if Murray or KCP was going to guard me and Gordon was going to be on Kawhi, well then I'll set the screen, put Kawhi on the block with a smaller player on him, like, you know, KCP or Jamal Murray or Bruce Brown, like we'll go at him that way as well. But it's just, you know, it's what the game turned into, especially with a bunch of guys or a bunch of teams that are going towards the switching lineups. Because it's just so hard. Like it's hard to be in coverage with the way the game is played now and how well teams shoot. You try to keep out of, you know, rotations as much as possible. And so like, yeah, you know, what Coach Malone did over there was smart, trying to get EG into the action to free up, you know, because we know where the ball is going. We know what's going to happen. And he's so good in the middle of the floor. You know, I think that's why it's so tough with Philly as well. You put Joel Embiid in the middle of the floor and now you can't double or you can't, you know, he could see all of that. You know,
when he's facing at the elbow or facing at the foul line, it's impossible to bring a double. Yeah.
No double. You can't double from right there. And so it's just, you're at his mercy at that point.
Well, JJ and I have talked about this a bunch. Are you surprised at all at the level of parity in the West?
Not really. Because like the young teams are they're not the young teams anymore. Like they've gotten better. They're experienced now. You look at what Memphis is doing. Sac has finally put it together. And then you got the veteran teams that just add guys after guys after guys. And ultimately, they form a team that's ready to compete just off of adding talent. You know, so not really. You know, I think this is what you expect, especially with these young teams that are figuring it out now.
You mentioned Sacramento. I know you've played in a lot of high level basketball games. I was calling the Suns game, so I didn't even get to watch it. I'm so mad. I saw highlights from regulation when you guys were supposed to foul. and then the overtime highlights, but was that the craziest game you've ever been a part of?
That was by far the craziest game. Like, the first quarter, it was like, all right, this is easily going to be a shootout. Like, because we weren't getting stopped. They weren't getting stops. We had fresh energy, having Russ in the lineup. So I knew we were going to be playing at a high pace. And that's Sacramento's MO, is play at a high pace. So I knew it was going to be a high scoring game, but almost 400 points combined by two teams. That's crazy.
Where are you at mentally by like overtime one when you're going through something like this?
I mean, you look up and it's 150, 153 tie. Like, we put up 153. You should win that game. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's just like, how long are we going here? Like, you know, we're exhausted. And we're playing against guys that are 25, 26. Like, we're exhausted. And they still, I know they got energy still. I know they played off of back-to-back, but when I played on back-to-backs, like, I loved it. I felt like I was more ready on a back-to-back night because I felt like, you know, my body was, like, warmed up at that point to play a back-to-back. So, for them, that back-to-back was nothing. We were playing against young legs. And I know if we didn't put that game away early, that it was in their hands at that point.
All right, a lot to unpack here because you guys are – the poster child right now for the discussion around load management. And I don't mean that as an affront. It's just a fact. You're the team that gets brought up more than anyone, whether it's you or, you know, specifically Kawhi a lot of times. And you mentioned the back-to-back, and I just want to note that unless it was just a crazy travel where you're going all the way up to Portland or you're changing two time zones, Going east to Denver, I think there was like a study one time and they were like 68-2 over a long stretch with teams that played in Pacific time, then went to Denver for the second night of a back-to-back. Other than those like anomalies, I agree with you completely. There's something about playing a game on consecutive days. Your body and the flow and the rhythm is there. So without question, I enjoyed it as well. There's a video circulating that after the game against Sacramento where I don't know what quite you asked. You know, there was some lip reading where you're like, do you want me to finish it? Do you want me to finish it? And they didn't put you back in the game. And so a lot of this discussion right now is that the players don't want to play. And I'm sure there's two-way communication. But specifically with your team, with you and Kawhi on this load management issue, what is sort of the communicative process like when you guys talk to the medical staff?
We want to play. That's the thing. We want to play. It's not that we want to sit out or, you know, we don't want to compete. Like, we want to play. But it's more so, you know, the way the game is now, it's such a, you know, analytical and, you know, we wear chips, they monitor your load off of chips. And so it's more so the training staff and the medical group just being mindful of, you know, in you know, Kawhi's situation coming off in a big time injury, is not to, you know, strain his body at this point and put, you know, a lot of load, you know, because at the end of the day, we're trying to get to the playoffs and that's when it counts and that's when it matters for us to be as healthy as possible going into the playoffs. And so if they can monitor how much we're putting on our body leading up to it, I think that's just what the key is for us just to stay healthy.
Yeah, I think Nate Jones, who works with Dame, has had some pretty strong takes on Twitter. I think he is thoughtful and intelligent about this. I don't think he's trying to get a rile out of people, but I tend to agree with him. I was talking with Richard Jefferson about this as well. And your perspective on this, I think, is important and unique given your serious injury that you had as well. And when you came into the league, when I came into the league. And one of the points that Nate makes and one of the points that RJ and I talked about is the culture that has been created by teams, not players, around load management. And I think that is getting lost right now in the nuance, because whether it's me, like you just said, with yourself, like there are times where you feel like I shouldn't be on a minutes restriction. I should be able to play in this game. And a team will tell, for me, it was always like, hey, you're running hot. We got to figure out a game to sit you out. And as an older player that didn't grow up in that culture, it was very easy for me to sort of be like, eh, nah, I'm going to play, or okay, I won't fight you on this one or whatever. But for a young player coming in now, that's the only thing they know is this culture around body monitoring, load monitoring. And that was not done by the players.
I think it starts off, like when I first came in the league, and you know, you came in the league a lot longer than I did. Not trying to age you at all, JJ.
Sorry.
But
the older we get, first of all, Paul, the older you and I get, the closer you are in age to me. You realize that, right?
That's true. That is true. But you know, when I came in the league, like, and I went to a blue collar team that worked extremely hard. That was like the norm. Like, practicing hard, you know, the two-a-days on training camp, like that was just like, that was the norm to me. And I enjoyed it and I loved it because it helped prepare me mentally. It helped prepare me physically. Like it prepared my body for what was to come in a long season. And I think now they're like, teams don't really practice, you know, we're not getting up and down. You know, there's just, it's a lost art when it comes to that hard practicing. And I think that's why there's so many injuries that's going on, because guys that have a high load day and then a completely off day, And then a high low day, you know, back then it was you practice hard, you got a game. You practice hard, you practice hard, you got a game. Then you might have a day off. Then you come right back to it. So I feel like your body just built a callus and that you were prepared for a long and rough season to where injuries, like, you know, there wasn't that many injuries. There wasn't time to take a load off because you like you felt good to play. You know what I mean? And I think now it's just it's tough. It's tough because it's almost the reverse. They think by giving us time off, it's helped managing our bodies. But in honesty, I think it's just making us weaker as players without putting that load and strain to our bodies.
One other thing I want to note on that, because I think it's a great point in terms of the practice load then leading to the game. And you've played now two seasons. This is your second season since I retired. So you've experienced this new schedule. And by new schedule, I mean, maybe it was 18, maybe it was 19, but somewhere around that time period, there was an emphasis with the scheduling around eliminating as many 4 and 5 nights, which I don't even know if they exist anymore, eliminating 5 and 7 nights, eliminating 3 and 4 nights. And on paper, I think it sounds great. I really do. I like that idea. The problem is, prior to them changing that, you would play 5 and 7, and maybe you finish on a Monday. You probably wouldn't play again till Friday. There was time to recover from nagging injuries. I can remember with Doc, you know, Doc was great about giving us days off when we needed them, and we would have a Monday game in LA and not play again till Saturday, let's say, and he'd say, I'll see you guys Thursday. And we would go in knowing Thursday and Friday are going to be hard practices. But now I get a little break here to recover, and you go in the, you know, you go in the gym, maybe you do your maintenance work, maybe you do your training table work, maybe you get your shots, but there was time. And now with the current schedule, it feels like it's game, day off, game, day off. There's no long breaks during the season where you have multiple days. I can't remember if it was T. Lou, but I know it was one of the coaches over this weekend. They said to me, they're like, we haven't had a 2-day break between games in over 7 weeks. All-star aside, it was back to like December before there was a 2-day break between games. Do you sense that sort of lack of longer time between games?
Yeah. I think that's tough on our schedules. Cause we just recently, like last month, I think is when we first started getting 2-day breaks in between going into the All-Star break. But before then we were every other day, if not a back to back. And like, it's no, like, I don't want to say it's, you know, Clippers fault or, like, I'm not saying that T. Lou doesn't practice us, but it is hard based off of our schedule of playing every other day to get good practice days in at this, on that note, you know what I mean? So, it's just the way the schedule is, like, they made it not so many games in a week span, but we're still every other day, which is, you know, I almost would do more games in the front and then get a little break, because those breaks, like, as much as it is physically, it's a good mental to get away from the game for like 2 days and then come back, you know, and know, all right, now we got another stretch. And that was the way we looked at it as in Indiana, like, all right, let's win this 5 out of 7. We got 2 days to recoup. And then let's target this next week. Let's target this, you know, 4 out of 6 this week. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's a different game, man. It's we're adjusting to it and we're trying to figure it out. But, you know, I think it is a different game from what we used to play.
You've been on now 3 different playoff teams. Do you feel like there's a sweet spot in terms of the on-the-court chemistry? In terms of like, do you guys have to play for a certain amount of time together and then it becomes they can set up a rhythm like that? I mean, I think this is the obvious challenge. You've an incredibly talented team now, but, you know, a lot of guys have not played very much together. And so it's just figuring it out on the fly heading into April and May.
There's a sweet spot. And again, it goes back to the practice. You know what I mean? I think that's where you work the kinks out and you expedite the process when you're on the floor with each other is through practice. But again, it's a tough job on T. Lou, man. We got new pieces, new guys added to the lineup, so he's still trying to figure out who works well, what's good in the rotations, you know, and you know, what's the best lineup to close, what's the best to start. Like, he's working through a lot of stuff. But I think, you know, again, it comes down to that practice time, like learning each other through practice, being on the same page to where when it gets in the game, it's easy. Like, I know what you're going to do. I know where you're going to be at. I know what you're looking for. You know, so I think it's, that sweet spot comes from, you know, that time that you can get together on off days.
If you've been following the pod, you know I'm stepping my suit game up as I'm calling more and more games. So shout out Indochino for getting me all prepared for this home stretch of games. It's also wedding season, so you can get in on looking great. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into the wedding season looking like $1 million, even though the suits start at just $499. You can either book an appointment at one of their showrooms or do what I did and set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website and choose customizations without even leaving the house. I just ordered a nice plum suit with pinstripes. I'm trying to tap into my inner Walt Frazier, and I think it's working. The entire process was super simple, and the suit fits great. That's the sweet spot. So look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code OLDMAN to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code OLDMAN. If you're like me and appreciate great quality, easy-to-wear clothes in your closet, let me introduce you to Rails. They're a Los Angeles-based brand that blends their California roots with an elevated European aesthetic, and the fabrics feel as good as they look. From super luxe button-downs and essential outerwear to vacation-ready shorts and tees, Rails is consciously crafted for the modern man on the move. With the sun coming out, I recently got myself a few short sleeve button downs, and they are super light and comfortable. Try Rails for yourself at their flagship stores in New York, San Francisco, Boston, London, Paris, and beyond, or at rails.com. And take 15% off your order with the code JJ. That's 15% off with code JJ at rails.com.
We have mentioned Kawhi a couple times recently on the podcast, and I know this morning one of the points that I made was how impressive it was, well, at least I was impressed, that coming off that double overtime game where both you and him played heavy minutes and he played 46, you guys were in the lineup on Sunday. And again, the expectation, like I said at the beginning of this show, is the expectation was you guys would probably, you know, rest. And with Kawhi specifically, over his last 19 games played, the stats are great, but it's, to me, it's the 37 minutes a game. And you've been around him now. This is your fourth season together. Obviously, he was hurt for an entire season. But when he's at his best, like he has been in this stretch, people talk about him being a robot because of the personality he portrays in the media. Mm-hmm. But to me, he's almost like a surgeon. There's such a precision. There's no wasted movement. There's never any wasted dribble. What do you see as his teammate, someone who has guarded him as a competitor? What is Kawhi at his best?
At his best, he is elite. Like, he's the best player on the floor when he's at his best. Like, there's no question on his game and his leadership. It's just crazy to watch him, like, on his practice days, his off days. Like, everything is a routine with Kawhi. Like, you, when they talk about Kobe and you hear stories about how MJ operated, it falls right in line with how Kawhi operates. Like, he'll go through a move and he'll make this basket 10 times. And then it's a progression from there. It's a counter from there. And then he'll go through that 10 times. And then it's a counter from there. And he'll go through that. Like, he'll go through about 5 or 6 counters just off of one move before he goes to another spot. Like, it's just crazy to watch him work and to watch him, you know, work on his craft. And, you know, when he's on the floor, it just gives you the ultimate confidence that, like, you know, we got him on our side. You know what I mean? Like, a guy that is a pure bucket. He loves the moment. You know, he doesn't shy away from the moment. He steps up in the biggest times. You know, even, you know, the slow start that he had, it was like, all right, he's, you know, we're good. He's getting good looks. He's getting good shots. Like, he's going to turn this game around at some point, and we're going to be in the game because of his shot making ability and his playmaking and, like, just his overall presence on the floor. I think that's another thing that doesn't get talked about is just his presence on the floor. Like, it is, and people, you watch him match up against other people. It's just an ultimate respect when it comes to Kawhi. Like, they know what he's about. They know, you know, that it's going to be a rough night. Like, nobody, the guys that talk the most trash don't say shit to Kawhi. Like, they know what it is. Whereas over here, they're like, oh, I can talk it to Paul. Like, he'll talk back. But, you know, Kawhi, it's respect over here.
I always tell this story. When we played the Spurs in 2015 in the first round, Kawhi guarded me for a lot of that series. And again, not an easy matchup for me physically. It was just, it was a little bit of a mismatch, but there was a play where him and I kind of got into, like, it wasn't a scuffle, but it was like, we were like tangled up and the ball, you know, kind of went away from us and, we got fouled, so it was a free throw, and we both went to go behind the 3-point line, and we were kind of running into each other's path, and I kind of just wanted to acknowledge that it was no beef, like, I'm just trying to play hard and compete, and so I kind of, like, all good, you know, tapped him on the stomach, and I remember thinking to myself, is he fucking made of steel? Like, what did I just touch? What did I just touch? And a great example of that was last night's game. I'm sure you remember this play, but, you know, Jokic is coming down the floor and he's matched up with Jokic, and Jokic tries to draw a flop. He walks into him and it's like Kawhi doesn't budge. So Jokic gets up. They set a pick and roll with Jamal Murray. He switches out. He knocks the ball away. Murray goes and gets the ball. He knocks the ball away again. And it's that the point you're making about his presence on the floor, like, it's beyond just the mid-range precision and the 3-point shooting. He's someone that, like, disrupts everything you're trying to do on the other end. And that's where I think for a wing player, when he's fully engaged and fully healthy, there's really no one better at that two-way thing.
Yeah, I remember, like, when, you know, when we would match up, when we weren't playing together, when we were matched up and I was in Indy and he was in San Antonio, or even Oklahoma and he was in Toronto, like, every time we matched up, it was like I gotta make sure I am, like, everything is efficient, because, like, you could lose Kawhi, but somehow, like, he's in the play. Like, I never understood it. Like, I could get by him sometimes, and, like, he's still there. Like, it's still a big ass hand that's coming to contest, and it's like, where did you come from? Like, he just has a knack and an ability to stay in a play. Like, it's almost impressive. Like, it is super impressive, because, like, as good as he's great, phenomenal defensively, but there's times where somebody might beat him, but then he, like, has this crazy ability. It's like his arms get longer, his fingers stretch further, and he has a way to get back into play that's, like, super impressive. It's like he just has this grip on the floor where he, you know, get anywhere and close anything off. It's crazy. It's crazy to watch. It is crazy to watch.
Yeah, you know, part of my job now, unfortunately, because I hate it, this is one of the things I hate, is prognosticating, because I believe in sort of the organic nature of basketball, and it's very hard to make predictions, because, to your point about practice, like, teams tinker and teams figure it out, and some teams peak at the right time, some teams don't. Matchups really matter. But when I look at you guys with Kawhi specifically, because I played against him now 3 times in the playoffs. One time I was hurt, obviously, with Dallas, but 15 in San Antonio, LA, 19 Philly, Toronto, 21 Clippers, Dallas. His game 6 is one of the all-time performances that I've ever witnessed in my life. It's hard for me to say, like, oh yeah, the Clippers, you know, they're whatever, 33-29, they're not a title contender. No, well, Kawhi's got two finals MVPs, you know? And so when you kind of look at your time with the Clippers, I want to go back. So 2020 was the bubble year. 2021, you guys make the Western Conference Finals, but Kawhi gets hurt in the Western Conference semifinals against the Utah Jazz. Kawhi's out 2022. And then this year, you're sitting in fifth place as of this recording. Where would you sort of assess where the Clippers are right now relative to the rest of the best teams in the NBA?
I think, honestly, I think our record, you know, you look at some teams and it's like, all right, their record doesn't indicate how good of a team they are. And I think that that's the case for us. Like, we're a team that, like, all right, you put us in a 7-game series with how well T. Lou coaches and his adjustments. Like, we're a team that's going to come out in a 7-game series when we're healthy. You know what I mean? Like, we'll make the adjustments. We got the personnel. We got the players that play and perform on the biggest stages. Like, we got proven winners on our side. I like where we're at. I like our chances. Like, we just, you know, I've missed 15 games. Kawhi's missed about 15 to 20 games. Like, we just haven't had the luck of being healthy for a full season and to be able to play with, you know, a full roster our whole season. And I think that's just where our record is indicating that. Like, we haven't had much practice time. We haven't had much on the court time, given with so many guys in and out of the lineup. Like, we're and now here we are again, adding Russell to the lineup. Eric, Mace, Bones, like, they're 3 games in. They're still figuring out our system. I think it's just, that's just what it comes down to for us. We just haven't had the luck of putting in good hours and good, you know, games and good practice days, being fully at our best. And when we get down to the stretch, like I said, 7 games, we're going to be a tough out.
Well, I wanted to go back for a second. I was looking this up today. Why were you not the number one or top five recruit in the country when you were in high school, based on just how obviously gifted you were at that age?
I was under the radar. I didn't play AAU really until going into my senior year. Like, that senior summer is when I really stepped onto the AAU scene. And I went to school in Palmdale. It's a little city outside LA. Nobody really knows about it. Super small. And again, I was just one of those players that was the Swiss Army knife on that AAU team. I was really good in my city, but then when I went AAU, I'm playing with Drew Holiday. I'm playing with Klay Thompson. I'm playing with, you know, the Ware twins, like a lot of these guys that went to these big schools that were really good in high school. And here I was, that was just trying to fit in and learn what this AAU thing was all about. And so I was just a late bloomer. Like, honestly, that's just what it came down to. I was a late bloomer, trying to learn and you know, figure out how do I match up with these guys that are, like, you know, top 10 in the country or top, you know, top 5 in California. Like, how do I match up with these guys? And so it was a learning. Like, it was definitely a learning experience for me.
I don't want to characterize you as a late bloomer in the NBA, because that's not, but I do remember in 2012, the lockout year, we played you guys in the first round, and you were in Indy, I was in Orlando, and there was some possessions that I had to guard you, and generally, like, you would just post me up and shoot a turnaround jumper, and you either made it or you missed it. I mean, and then Stan was like, all right, I'm gonna mimic JJ's minutes with Leandro Barbosa's minutes, you know? So it was like, all right, that's fine. But I do remember there was a possession. It was during a free throw or coming out of a timeout or something, where I asked you a question and you were just like, man, I need to have the ball in my hands more. And I was like, okay. And everyone in Indy was so high on you, and everyone around the league was like, oh, this guy's going to be really good. And to me, I think what has been impressive about your growth, and honestly, what is untapped, you know, or tapped all of your potential, is your ball handling. And that's such an underrated part of your game. I don't know if you had that at Fresno State. I don't know if you had that in college. I'm not even sure if you had it in your rookie year, because I don't know if they gave you the opportunity to do it. But that's the part of your game where you became very difficult to guard when you tighten your handle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was everything I had to learn. Like, as a kid, I was just starting out to play, like, you know, organized basketball. And I was the tallest kid. And it used to kill me inside that they would put me in the post. And I always saw myself as being a guard. Like, I would watch Kobe, I would watch T-Mac, I would watch, you know, all the long wings, and watch how they operated on the perimeter. And I was like, man, that's who I am. That's who I want to be. Like, I want to be a guard. I want to be a wing. I want to, like, there's value in my size and to be able to handle it. You know, so early on, like in Indiana, and again, I wasn't a defender. Like, defense was, I would say, the last part that came to me as a player. I wasn't good defensively. I had slow feet. You know, I had a knack for, you know, being in the right spot, but I wasn't good on the ball. And at the time, we had Jim O'Brien as our head coach. And, you know, he always would tell me, like, if you want to get on the floor, like, you got to play defense. And that was it. That's when the light bulb blinked for me, that, like, all right, I got to learn how to play defense. I, like, this has got to be my knack. I got to, like, be special on the defensive side. And that was the way of seeing the floor. Like, that's when I started getting minutes, when I started defending. And then I got really good at that. And then now it's like, all right, now I'm on the floor. Like, I need touches. Like, because for a young guy, you get stuck in a corner. Like, that becomes your offense. Every play that they drew up, I knew where I was going to be at. There was no question of me asking, like, oh, what's the play? Like, well, what are we in? I knew whatever it was, I'm in a corner. And so it was just like, all right, like, how do I start to get pick and rolls? Like, how do I start to bring the ball up? Okay, I gotta get better with my dribbles. I gotta get better with my handles. Like, I started to, you know, increase my volume on practice days and the summers of shooting threes. Like, how do I get good? You know, if I'm going to be a space out guy, like, how do I get good at shooting threes? How do I get consistent? So I started doing that. So everything, it was just, you know, an involvement, but, you know, it was just me being hungry about it. Like, I'm not going to be okay with just being on the floor and then I can't showcase what I could do. And that's really when it changed for me. And then when Danny got hurt and went out, it was like, all right, it's go time. Like, everything that I've worked on, everything that I've you know, put hours in the gym and these long summers, this is my time. And I went for it and it paid out.
I've just, Tommy, real quick, it's interesting because there's a lot of players that have said similar comments to me on the basketball floor. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether or not they put in the work, but there's no way you're going to get the ball in your hands more if you don't put in the work. So that's a credit to you.
Like, I wasn't a big fan of Jim O'Brien, but what he helped me with was that, like, separation between college and NBA. Like, he flipped that switch of, like, all right, this is next level coaching. This is, like, they're going to be hard on you. I remember, like, I would, you know, and again, remember, I would say defense was my calling as a rookie. So, you know, we have practice days and I'm like, I'm dogging the starters. I'm defensively, I'm all over them. Steals, like, you know, shutting the floor down, help side, low man, like, I'm blocking shots. And I remember one play, I stole the ball. I forget who I stole it on, but I stole the ball and Jim O'Brien stops the practice and goes, like, are you seriously going to let this skinny fucking prick steal the ball from you? And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, ain't that good? Like, what? It fucked me up. Like, it messed me up that, like, you know, his way of coaching, it was just so, like, just raw.
Old school. You know, it was,
I mean,
old school.
He said what he
it was old
super
school.
Old school.
Yeah.
He said what he wanted to say, and like, he just had no filter.
I wish you would have had him as an assistant, because he was the best, bro. Him as an assistant, especially later in his, I mean, this was 18, this is 8 years after you had him, you know, it was, dude, he was the best.
What do you think about now?
Fat of him.
When you look back at those playoff runs, the Indy playoff runs, you've played in a lot of big games since then. You know, how has your perspective sort of shifted on what you guys accomplished? Because even though you didn't, you know, win a championship, it was a pretty great, you know, 3-4 year stretch.
Yeah, it was a fun ride, man. It was a fun ride because, like, we built all of it. You know what I mean? The organization built all of it. They drafted those guys, and then they brought in the leadership that we needed in David West and, you know, George Hill. Like, they brought in the other pieces that we needed. But for the most part, it was built. Danny was drafted there. Roy was drafted there. I was drafted there. Lance was drafted there. And, like, we literally spent, like, off days together. Like, we were together all the time. And I think that's, like, the greatest thing. I've never been on a team since that's been that close, where we were, you know, we have a dinner and you can pretty much guess how many was going to be. And it was going to be about 10 of us there. Like, on any given night, we have a team dinner. It was going to be about 10 guys at that dinner. Like, that's how close we were. And it showed on the court. We weren't the most talented, but because we were so close, because we spent hours in the gym practicing, learning together, like, we were on a string. We knew what everybody was going to do. We knew, all right, I can be aggressive. Like, going into it, me on the perimeter, I knew I could be aggressive, and I knew that I could be a playmaker because Roy was going to be there every time. Roy was going to be low man. He was going to protect the paint, be at the rim every time. You know what I mean? Roy knew he could be up and picking rolls because I was going to fight over those screens as hard as I could every time. So it was just like, you know, that group that was there, like, we just trusted each other. And we literally, like, brought the best out of everyone.
I don't know when you guys switched. I know by 2014, my first year with the Clippers, that you had switched to heavy drop coverage. But in some ways, I feel like those teams, because of your defensive success, changed the modern NBA. And I really mean that, because for the first 7-8 years of my career, the five man, more often than not, and certainly teams would play five men back in pick and roll coverage, but not to the extent that you guys eventually did with Roy. But more often than not, teams would have the five man up, especially if you were, you know, guarding anybody that could shoot off the dribble. They had the five men up in pick and roll, and then you relied heavily on the low man. If it's a spread pick and roll, you'd bring the guy over. He would bump the roller at the nail, but the roller would always get behind the defense. And then you guys started basically in pick and roll, Roy all the way in the back. That's how everybody plays now. And I even remember, like, it was my first year with the Clippers. We played you guys on a road trip. And I remember just coming off pick and rolls and dribble handoffs, feeling like I was wide open. And I shot 4 for 18 that game. Like, because teams have taught it better, whether it's snaking or putting somebody in jail. Like, nobody was teaching that back then. And so you'd come off and you'd kind of get in this no man's land of, like, oh, I can't get all the way to the rim, and I've surpassed, you know, the pull-up jumper. So I'm taking these tough leaners or these tough floaters, and you've got you and Lance and George, all these guys, bigger, stronger, longer guys. And I really do believe that, like, when you guys made that switch and put Roy in heavy drops, like, that changed how everybody guarded in the NBA.
Yeah, and we, like, back then you could be physical too. You know what I mean? You could be physical. We would jump into, whether it was coming off a DHO or a pin down, like, we were physical getting through that screen. And so it helped Roy kind of be back because, you know, 9 times out of 10, we were getting over that screen or getting through that screen. And so he never had to be up. That was our coverage, man. That was our coverage. Keep Roy in the hole. He'll protect everything. And you know, at that point, like teams, it was starting to get to that analytical game where like layups or threes. Yeah. And mid-range was like, we'll take it. You shoot a mid-range, we'll take it because we're going to rear view contest. And that's a hard shot to make when you're flying off a screen and now you got to slow down to get balance. And then you got a guy chasing you from behind. So you're trying to see where is he coming from. And now you're trying to lock back onto the rim. That's a tough shot to make. And so that was that's what we were like forcing guys to do. Like if you're going to be comfortable here, it's just going to be a long night. Like we're willing to lose that way if you make shots in this range right here, but that's the shot that we're going to give you.
We didn't make the change in LA till 2016, which was my third year there. And it was so foreign to me because with Dwight, and some of it was just Dwight was so mobile. We always had him up and DeAndre was the same way. And so we just relied on that backside, low man, the nail guy, whatever. Even with strong side pick and rolls, we didn't always ice, so you'd get that corner bump. And for me, is you know, when I would guard like a CJ McCollum and he's coming off and he's shooting floaters in mid-range, like it was a foreign thing. And it was hard for me to trust, you know, when you're guarding CJ and he's hitting shots, like it's a hard thing to trust. Did you guys initially, I know you mentioned the physicality and you guys were able to get through, but initially, was there any like turning back to the coaching staff every time somebody hit a mid-range pull-up? Because for our team that first year, it was like everybody, and now everybody runs it, but it was initially a little bit hard to sort of justify in the moment. Whereas when you look at the analytics, you're like, okay, now it makes sense.
Yeah, to be honest, there wasn't many teams that burnt us on that. You know what I mean? There wasn't many teams that like, we had a rough, like the games we lost, the score was like in the 80s. You know what I mean? Like that team wasn't making shots and we weren't making shots. Like we didn't really get killed in that range. You know what I mean? We were really good. And you know, if that was the shot teams were going to take, they weren't efficient there because of the rear view and us getting through. Like the teams weren't killing us in that mid-range area of shooting floaters. And it wasn't a lot of guys that really shot that. That mid-range, you know, float game, or it wasn't that many guys, or especially the guard that got to that, you know, that float range. So we were good.
Do you have a favorite Lance story?
I do. I got a lot of funny and great Lance stories. This is a good one. I remember. So like Lance didn't have some shoes, right? And, equipment guy, Josh, was our equipment guy in Indiana. He just gave Mike Dunleavy some Kobe's and he boxed them up, put them on his seat. So like Mike's expecting these Kobe's on his chair. So Mike walks in and he's like, you know, Josh, where are my shoes at? Like, the soles, like, and Lance ripped out the inner soles, put them in a box, shut the box, and just took the Kobe's out. So Mike opens the box and just sees his soles in there. He's like, who the fuck took my soles out and left them in the box and took my shoes? And like 10 minutes later, you hear Lance coming in and he turns the corner and he's these fresh Kobe's on. And Mike's like, no way. What? Like, Lance, what the fuck are you doing? And Lance is like, yo, what? Like, oh, these is yours? Yo, I just saw some shoes. So I didn't know they was yours. Like, my bad, yo.
Some shoes,
Mike,
son.
Was so hot, man. Mike was so mad. You know, and it was funny as hell because that was Lance. Like, Lance would do the wildest shit. But he was the best teammate, most funniest guy I've been around. I remember Tyler Hansbrough had like some ear infection. And, you know, so his ear was like, you know, sensitive and it was bothering him. So like after the game, we're walking back to our locker. Lance goes up to Tyler, like, let's go, motherfucker. Screams loud as fuck in his ear. Tyler's like, oh, what the fuck, man? What are you doing? And he just chases Lance in the locker room. And we had to break the two. We had to separate the two. But it was just Lance, man. Lance was the prankster. He was the jokester. He was a fun locker room guy, man. It was great times with Lance.
I was fortunate enough to be Lance's teammate with the Clippers as well. And I thoroughly enjoyed the experience. I have nothing negative to say about the experience. It was just
you was in for a treat, man.
Day to day, it was just you were gonna get something. I don't know. I could never predict right. what it was gonna be, but you were gonna get something. OM3 fans, I need to tell you about the most comfortable pants out there. They're from Vuori, and they're magnificent. I'm not kidding. Jason told me about them. He called them butter on your legs. Vuori provides a new perspective on performance apparel, perfect if you are sick and tired of traditional old workout gear. Everything is designed to work out in, but doesn't look or feel like it. So comfortable, you will want to wear it all the time, and I do. Honestly, it's comfier than whatever you're wearing right now. Now, the pants I mentioned up top is called the Men's Sunday Performance Jogger. Grab yourself a pair. It'll change your life. Vuori is an investment in your happiness. For our listeners, they are offering 20% off your first purchase. Get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet at Vuori.com/JJ. That's Vuori.com/JJ. Not only will you receive 20% off your first purchase, but enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75 and free returns. Go to Vuori.com/JJ and discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The blow-by in Game 2 in 2013 in the Eastern Conference Finals, the blow-by of LeBron awesome. and the dunk on Birdman, I feel like it's not often. There's maybe series, there's maybe games where someone burst into superstardom. For you, it felt like a moment. It felt like a singular event. Did you feel that at the time?
I felt it. Because the whole lead up, you know, we had got past, I think Melo played well that series. And then now it was, you know, the matchup against Bron. And I felt good. I felt great about it. I felt like, you know, I've worked my way up into this moment. I'm playing against the best. And then this is just a measuring stick. Like, where do I match up against this guy? And yeah, man, I honestly felt like I was one of them ones. I was on my way. You know, I was ready for that matchup. I was ready. I was ready to take that leap. We were playing well. And it was just like, it just felt like it was our time. It was our time to finally turn the corner.
You averaged, basically 26-5 on 47-44 shooting splits. You were actually better the following year. You guys lost in six the next year. 24, 11 rebounds, 5 assists on 45-40 splits. Like, that was obviously pre-injury, but those Heat teams specifically with Bron and D-Wade and Bosch, can you just describe the challenge of beating them? Because you guys had leads in those series. The challenge of beating LeBron four times in a playoff series.
Yeah, well, when you brought up Roy, that was the toughest thing for us, was when they put Chris Bosh at the five. That changed the whole like landscape when we matched up against Miami, because now Roy couldn't stay in the paint and Roy had to come out on the perimeter because of Chris Bosh. And Chris was shooting the shit out of it. Like he was cash from three. And it really made it tough. Like, and it was a mental like knock to Roy that like we couldn't put him on the floor sometimes. And Roy's like, what do you mean? Like I'm, you know, a defensive player candidate. Like, what do you mean I can't be on the floor? But it was so tough because they spread us out. They had a five out with Chris Bosh sitting at the top of the key. And so that was just him. And then you got Bron, best player in the world at that point. You know, it just, you know, we know what Bron is. D-Wade was struggling early, but then he figured it out. He became himself later in that series. It got to we hit the fork in the road where we went up against a team that was more talented and just better than us. You know what I mean? Like our talent took us so far that, you know, we were outmatched at that point.
I wanted to ask about OKC for a second, because, you know, you had in those 2 years, you had some incredible individual performances, and we can, you know, run through a few of them. But when you're thinking about just the playoffs in general, even like you guys getting ready for, you know, hopefully a deep playoff run this year, what do you think the X factor in terms of winning in the playoffs is? Because there's only so much you as an individual can do. There's only so much you could do in Indy, and there's almost only so much you could do there.
Like, you know, it's tough. I think you need those guys. I think your bench becomes extremely important. Like the bench is the X factor in playoffs. They become extremely important in the playoffs, because in the playoffs, the top guys, your go-to guys, your elite guys, for the most part, they're going to be consistent. They're going to win the games. Like that's what they're paid for. But you need that sixth man, that seventh man to win you a game, or win, you know what I mean? You need them to win you a game in like a game five, or like that's when they come important, when they can win one of those games where your star player is, he's exhausted or he's not playing well, he's not shooting it well, it's a rough night for him. Like that's where that bench comes into play. And those are the X factors, to be honest. Like those guys that can go out and win you a game in a series that gets you past, you know what I mean? That moves you on. So you need those guys. And that's what I like about what we got over here. Like we got a couple of those guys that can win us a series, or win us a game in a series. But to your question, like, I think that's just what it comes down to, because everybody knows what you're doing. There's no tricks. There's no cheats. It comes down to both teams dueling it out. We know their X's and O's. They know our X's and O's. It's just about, you know, we got to run our shit crisp. They got to run their shit crisp. The stars are going to show up. They're going to show out. But you need those, you know, six, seven, eight men on the roster to perform at a high level on, you know, it doesn't have to be a nightly basis, but they got to come through on, you know, one of those occasions to win you a game.
I agree with you on that. I want to add on just my sort of perspective or thoughts on winning the playoffs. A lot of times it comes down to, do you have the best player in the series? Then obviously, is your best player playing at his peak? And to your point about the bench, sometimes to me, at least in my experience, can your bench or can a key substitution, i.e. the 10 minutes your best player doesn't play, can you not lose those 10 minutes by 8 points? Can you be even in those 10 minutes? Because your point is valid about, you know, if you're outmatched, you're going to lose the series. If you're evenly matched, a lot of times you're right. It does come down to those, what seems like, you know, meaningless minutes, but it could be 4 minutes in a third quarter. It could be 2 minutes to start the fourth. I've seen so many times playoff games lost that way. Tommy brought up your time in OKC, and I wanted to get your perspective on the flow of your game and the differences between being the guy and the very clear guy like you were in Indiana and being a guy with other superstars like you are now mm-hmm. with the Clippers, like you were in OKC when Russ was still at his peak, and obviously Melo, you know, getting a lot of usage as well. Just the differences in the flow and the feel of that offensively for you.
Yeah, my early years in Indy, I was in that phase of like, that's what you want. You want to be the guy. You want to be the go-to. You want everything to fall on you. So I was in that space. But then after, you know, years of being there, going through injuries, and then seeing how the league was shaping up, it was like, man, I can't do this alone. Like, and so that evolved to like, all right, like, how can I be of service to a team? And I didn't know where I was going to go. I didn't know where I was going to get traded when I requested a trade out of Indiana. I ended up falling in Oklahoma with a superstar MVP candidate or MVP winner, superstar with Russ. And initially it was just like, okay, how, like, this is different. This is obviously a different role for me, not being the guy anymore. But like, how can I be of service and bring what I do and add to what he's doing? And honestly, I felt like that was where my place was. Like, I had to be honest to myself that, like, in order for me to win at the highest level or get to where I want to get to, I don't think I'm the one guy. I don't think, but I can score with the best. I can, you know, take over games with the best, but I don't honestly think that's what my game is. If I want to win a championship, I don't think that's where my place is. If I want to win a championship. And I felt like I learned that. I played my best being off the ball, being, you know, the second fiddle. I had my best career playing alongside Russ in that role. So, you know, I just pride myself to be like, be able to play with anybody and play any style, any way you want me to play. I feel like I can just fit right in. But I think that's just what my role was. And I felt comfortable in that space of just being the second guy.
I want to just acknowledge, I'm being serious here. You may have said that publicly before. I just want to acknowledge and sort of give some credit to you. I guess it's self-awareness, but like, I don't think there's many guys that have been the guy that are willing to sort of go that far to acknowledge it. And look, that is not me saying, hey, Paul, you definitely couldn't be the best player on a championship team. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is to have that self-awareness based on your own experience, I think that's rare. I think that's rare in the NBA.
Listen, JJ, I am confident with who I am. I'm confident in what I can do. The game's been good to me. I made a shit ton of money playing this beautiful game, man. I don't have no ego when it comes to basketball. I just want to win. And I haven't won at any level. I haven't won in high school, I haven't won in college, I haven't won in the NBA. And so if you're that guy, it's like, all right, like, how do I win? Like, what do I do? What do I have to do to win? And if it's, you know, being a piece and not the whole piece, then that's what it is. Like, and I'm comfortable in that space. Like, I don't need my ego stroked. Yeah, people say like, oh, Pete, you are a you know, you are 1A. You and Kawhi are 1A, 1B. Like, I thank you for stroking the ego, but like, I have no shame in being like, Kawhi's the one, I'm the two, and we can operate, you know, together. You know what I mean? If he goes down, I'll take over and pick up the lifting. Like, you know what I mean? I'm very comfortable in that space. And so, you know, it is a self-aware thing, because there's guys that don't think that, or there's guys that, you know, go beyond their prime and they think that they're still, you know, in their prime, and it's a tough pill to swallow. But for me, I have no problem with, you know, being honest with myself. And that's just what it comes down to.
That's very fair. Paul, before we let you go, just because you and I have never talked about this, and obviously I've read articles about it, I can't let you go without asking about your injury, and I don't want to get into sort of the gruesomeness of it, but I'm very curious just about the recovery process, the mental toll. I was thinking about any injury I never had major injuries, but any injury I came back to is like really about just making small goals. Whether it was like a 3-week hamstring injury or a 6-month back injury, it was just about making small goals. But when you're coming back from something like that, the approach and to your credit, you got hurt in August and you were playing by the end of the following season, your approach to get back on the court, the taxing sort of mental side of that. What was that?
Man, when people say give it your all, I gave it literally my all. When it happened, first it was just so much emotion involved because I'm at the height of my career. I got a chance to play for my country. Just, you know, finished playing against Bron. We took them to a tough, I think, 6 games. And I felt like one more year. And I truly felt like it was my time. One more year, we figured them out. I'm going to get better. I'm coming back with a ton of confidence from playing with the Olympic team. Like I really felt good about where I was at leading up to it. Then I get hurt, and then just the emotions of like not of the unknown. Like, will I ever play again? Will I be the same again? Like, will this team be the same team I'm coming back to? It was just a lot that was going on. But the rehab and recovery role, it was brutal, man. Like, I remember like the first, like once you get past the point of the injury and being hospitalized, you know, I was hospitalized for like a week before I took off from Vegas. I was in Vegas in the hospital for about a week before I went to Indiana. And, you know, once I got to Indy, that's when it kind of settled in that like, damn, this is going to be hard. This is going to be rough. And I just remember, man, like some days I was just like, don't, like, I just wanted to be shut off from the world. Like, nobody reach out to me. Nobody talk to me. Nobody message me. Like, I don't want to do treatment. I don't want to rehab. Like, I remember telling the trainer some days, like, man, just leave me alone. Like, let this thing heal. And when it heals, then we can start rehabbing. Like, that's just, it was the pain that I was going through that, you know, I've never been hurt or injured in my career up to this point. So it was just new to me. And like, I literally just had to tackle every day. Like, And I would check out because it just became like it every day, like was the same day. It was just tedious work, like literally doing the same thing for a month, same schedule, same time I had to be in, like same workouts I was doing, same treatment I was doing. And it just became like I was a robot. Like, you know, I was just checking out. Like it just became boring doing this stuff. But, you know, shout out to Indy. The trainers were phenomenal. They kept me like on a straight path. But there was days I wanted to give up. There was definitely days I wanted to give up. I just, you know, my family gave me the support to keep going, and that was enough that I needed. But it was tough, man. It was one of the hardest things I ever went through in my life.
The monotony of rehab from any injury and a prolonged recovery process. I think you're sort of referencing boredom. And I think that's when you're talking about checking out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's that component. But there's also the component of just not being able to play. And I think for anybody who loves to play, that's the thing. So you're on one side, you're not sort of getting the fulfillment and the enjoyment of playing because that's not an option. But then there's like, I don't know if it's guilt or anger, but it's like the anger of of not being able to do it, of missing out, and then having to do that for weeks, months, in your case, a very long, you know, whatever it was, 8 months, 9 months to get back. Yeah, I can't imagine going through that every day.
Yeah, and I felt like I felt the pain for the guys that were in Indy. Like, it wasn't even about me anymore. I felt like the life was sucked out of Indiana. When the guys were getting ready for training camp, it was almost like, what are we doing this for? Like, why are we here? The life literally looked like it, the life was literally drained from that team. And I just felt bad for those guys, like what we built, what we've went through. And now, like, and that was the end of the era. Like, when I came back that season, D. West was gone. Roy Hibbert was gone. You know, Lance was gone. Like, that was the end of an era after that injury. And so it was tough, man. It was tough to watch those guys go through it that year and really have, like, there was no end goal that season. There was no chance of making playoffs. There was no chance of going further. Like, D. West was on his last, like, you know, this is his last stint before he went to Golden State to go win one. But, like, that was his last, you know, he was on his last years. And for me, like, being a young guy that, you know, respected D. West, I wanted to give him as many chances that I could of getting deep in the playoffs and possibly winning it. So it was tough. It was tough to just watch the whole team just, you know, the life just get sucked out of him because of my injury.
PG, we appreciate the time, man. This has been awesome. Really looking forward to not only listening to your podcast, but being a guest on your pod. I've already committed
Absolutely,
to that.
This
I've
was
already
great.
Committed to Love that.
This is great. So, based off this interview, it's going to be an awesome show.
Yeah. No, we appreciate it, bro. This is awesome. And I'm sure I'll call one of your games soon. I'll see you very, very soon.
Sounds good. Thank you guys.
Oh, yeah. PG, thanks, man. That was awesome. Thank you.
If you like The Old Man of the Three, you can listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.